Good afternoon. Welcome to Corporations and Democracy, the program that examines how corporations dominate our democracy and what citizens are doing to replace corporate dominance with true democracy. I'm Steve Scalmanini with co-host Jenny Esposito. The opinions expressed on Corporations and Democracy are those of our guests and the host, and not necessarily of the management of Mendocino County Public Broadcasting. Well, today Annie and I will be speaking with the author of a new book, from which there was a book signing just last month in Ukiah that caught our attention immediately. The book is called Refinery Town, Big Oil, Big Money, and the Remaking of an American City. And it is the story of how Richmond, California, went through a decade of grassroots organizing that led to the political transformation of the city, making it one of the most progressive and safest cities in the nation. The book's author and our guest today is Steve Early. Steve has been active as a labor journalist, lawyer, organizer, and union representative since 1972. In the 90s, he worked for the United Mine Workers and wrote for the UMW Journal. Then for 27 years, he was a Boston-based staff member of the Communications Workers of America. He now serves on the editorial advisory committees for four labor-related publications. He's also a law school graduate and admitted to the bar in Vermont. He's also written four books over the years. In 2009, it was Embedded with Organized Labor, Journalistic Reflections on the Class War at Home. A couple of years later was published The Civil Wars in U.S. Labor, Birth of a New Workers' Movement or Death Throes of the Old. And in 2014, his book Save Our Unions, Dispatches from a Movement in Distress was published. And now, earlier this year, was published the book we'll be discussing today, Refinery Town, Big Oil, Big Money, and the Remaking of an American City. So, let's have a look at how Richmond, California went from a company town to a town for everyone. Steve Early, welcome to Corporations and Democracy.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, thanks so much for being here. Senator Bernie Sanders wrote the foreword to your book, and he said, in a wonderful summation of it, "The inspiring electoral victories in Richmond would not have been possible without the prior development of multi-issue, multi-racial, progressive organization." So Refinery Town is a study of that transformation, and of course there was a lot of work behind it. Why don't we begin with the refinery itself in Refinery Town, Chevron. So who is Chevron?
Well, Chevron, as many of us who drive cars in California knows, is a major supplier of gasoline for our vehicles. It is a global energy giant, started out in life more than 100 years ago as the company known as Standard Oil of California, almost since the company's founding in the early years of the last century. It has had a major refinery in Richmond. Richmond is a community, an industrial city in the East Bay, just up the coast from the better-known Berkeley and Oakland, and across the bay from San Francisco. Chevron is Richmond's biggest taxpayer, biggest employer, biggest philanthropist, and for many decades, sadly, also the biggest local polluter of politics and air and water. The community is about 105, 110,000 people at this point, 80% non-white, 40% Latino, 30% Asian, 30% African-American, 10% Asian. You know, it's a poor and working-class community where 20% of the population lives at or below the poverty level. And in many Richmond neighborhoods, which are downwind from the Chevron refinery, the issue of environmental justice and community health has been a very pressing one for many years because of refinery fires and accidents like the one that occurred in Richmond nearly 5 years ago this August.
Yeah, I noticed the union says that Chevron commits daily safety violations and is negligent in maintenance, making for daily dangerous leaks. And, of course, it's also the 14th biggest corporation in the whole country. So it looms over Richmond physically as well as probably in every other way in Richmond.
Yeah, it's kind of sometimes hard to get your hands around the scale of a company like Chevron. The oil industry obviously has its profit margins have suffered recently as a result of the drop in oil prices, but as recently as 2 years ago, Chevron was earning global profits of $4 to $5 billion. In the year of our big fire here in 2012, Chevron had worldwide revenues of more than $250 billion and profits of $26 billion. So one problem that we face in the community and it's a problem faced by state and federal regulators, you know, when you try to assess penalties or fines against a company of that scale and wealth, what they end up paying for their corporate misconduct, their negative impact on the environment, their workplace safety violations really do amount to a series of slaps on the wrist, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell us about the Richmond Progressive Alliance, then. They are a main player in the whole saga. What exactly is that? When did it get started, and how did it get started?
Well, the Richmond Progressive Alliance is a 14-year-old organization. It is both a membership group with about 300 individual dues-paying members and several organizational affiliates, unions and community organizations concerned about immigrant rights, gay rights, and the environment. It is unusual to the extent that it not only engages in electoral politics at the municipal level, but it has a year-round multi-issue organizing program and has really been a leader of all the fights in Richmond over the last 10 to 15 years to defend undocumented workers, to raise the city's minimum wage, to curb police misconduct and reform the police department, to protect tenants through, and homeowners through anti-foreclosure measures, and more recently the adoption of rent control to try to put pressure on Chevron so that it'll pay its fair share of taxes, try to neutralize the impact of Chevron's big money in local politics. And it's an organization that's had a very, very successful track record. Since 2004, progressives in Richmond have been able to win 10 out of 16 municipal races for city council or mayor. And for an eight-year period between 2006 and 2014, Richmond was the largest city in the country with a green mayor, Gail McLaughlin, who's still a member of the city council, and who last week announced that she was going to run statewide an independent progressive campaign for lieutenant governor of California.
Hmm. All right, so it's pretty amazing. This Richmond Progressive Alliance was key in mounting a successful answer to Chevron. Chevron did some of its own work for the alliance when there was that huge refinery fire in 2012, and I guess there was problems before with releases, but this was the one that was the most dangerous with huge black clouds and everybody sheltering in place, and also it's pretty dramatic. Do you want to talk a little bit about 2012, the refinery fire?
Yeah, we had my wife and I just moved to Richmond a few months before in early 2012 after living and working for more than 30 years in the Boston area. The refinery property starts just down at the end of our street, and we were here when the sirens went off and the shelter-in-place was declared by our mayor. Shelter-in-place, we learned, is a kind of an emergency protocol whereby people affected by refinery fires and explosions go indoors, close their windows and doors, and try to tape them up and turn off the air conditioner. Pretty primitive methods to respond to an environmental catastrophe of the scale of the one that occurred here nearly 5 years ago. In the couple of days after the fire, which took 4 hours to put out and nearly killed 19 refinery workers. About 15,000 refinery neighbors in Richmond and other communities were forced to seek medical attention at just about every clinic and emergency room in the area. There were multiple investigations of the causes of the fire, which the U.S. Chemical Safety Board found were a result of Chevron's longstanding practice of putting profits and production ahead of safety. The company had neglected key pipe maintenance work, and as a result of corrosion in a key pipe and a leak being sprung and petroleum vapor then igniting, you had a major assault on the environment, on air quality, and the company pleaded guilty to some criminal charges, paid about $2 million in penalties and restitution. It's being sued by the city of Richmond. 4 years of ongoing litigation yet to be resolved. City seeking millions of dollars in damages from the company. The company got the largest Cal OSHA fine in the history of the state for its workplace safety violations and $1 million fine that it is still appealing. So the legacy of the fire is very much alive in efforts by labor and environmental groups to strengthen California's refinery safety rules. There's been some progress on that front recently, and also to get our regional air quality board to come up with some stronger curbs on refinery emissions.
One of the things I got from your book that I think is really important is that this fire in 2012 was the spark, but the community organizing that preceded it for years and years, maybe decades, was the kindling that made the spark take.
Yeah, the downwind neighborhoods in Richmond, North Richmond, the neighborhood known as the Iron Triangle, other poor and working class, predominantly black and Latino neighborhoods, started organizing to demand that Chevron clean up its act back in the 1980s. There was a great group led by a pioneering environmental justice campaigner, Dr. Henry Clark. He formed the West County Toxics Coalition, helped file some of the initial lawsuits challenging Chevron's repeated safety, environmental, and environmental law violations. Community labor agitation has really been essential to getting the company over time to adopt safer practices. But there has very definitely been a long and well-documented history of leaks, explosions, fire spills, toxic gas releases, you know, flaring leading to air contamination. And this is a problem at the three or four other major refineries in our county, Contra Costa County. It's also a problem at Southern California refineries. And in all of these communities, we've seen similar environmental justice campaigning to try to hold these big oil companies accountable.
I think one of the things that Richmond is really famous for is the reworking of the police force. So that's kind of like a beautiful illustration of how this works. This is like sort of a how-to thing, although it ain't easy. I think you're going to make that clear. But you want to do a little kind of a description of what Richmond did to change the policing from a disaster to a benefit for the community?
Well, when progressives started running for municipal office in Richmond in 2004 and when Gail McLaughlin first got elected in 2006, one of the major challenges facing City Hall in that period was how to clean up, how to reform a really dysfunctional police department, a police department that looked a lot like big city police departments that we've been reading about so much in the last few years. The police in Richmond at that time were not representative of the community. It was 60% white police force. The cops functioned as a kind of occupying army. They used really aggressive and brutal tactics against young people of color in Richmond. Several young men were shot and killed, costing the city hundreds of thousands of dollars in settlements and civil rights suits and damage suits. They were known for harassing Latino day laborers and Hispanic-looking drivers at random checkpoints. They were cooperating with the Immigration and Naturalization Service at that point. They beat up Latino community activists at a Cinco de Mayo festival in 2002. And by 2005, gang activity and gun violence and homicide rate in the city were so high that some people in the city council were calling for deployment of the National Guard. Progressives came up with a different approach. They hired a pioneering police reformer, proponent of community policing, by the name of Chris Magnus. He had formerly been the police chief in Fargo, North Dakota, a very different kind of community. He's also a gay police chief, one of the few in the country. And as I describe in the book, I think in one of its strongest chapters, Chris came in and over the next 10 years, engineered a major overhaul in the police department, got rid of some of the bad apples, did a lot of hiring to make the police force more diverse, more reflective of the community. And he really redefined the role of the patrol officer, trying to connect people to the community that they're trying to make safer, requiring them to meet and work with churches and community organizations and neighborhood councils and nonprofits. Promotions and career advancements in the Richmond Police Department now are not dependent on how many people you arrest, how many tickets you issue, but you know how many relationships you build. And there's really been extraordinary change in the relationship between the police and the community. Major decline in both property crimes and homicide rate. And in a community where there is still a lot of gun violence, only two officer-involved fatal shootings in the last 12 years, a period during which, sadly, about 250 young people of color, mainly men between the ages of 15 and 30, have killed each other on the streets of Richmond, a continuing problem that both the police and community organizations are struggling with on a daily basis.
One question I have about the 2004, when the new police chief came in, what happened to the previous one, and was there any drama associated with that?
No, I mean, there was the usual revolving door that we've seen in a lot of cities, which I think is, you know, part of the problem, or at least I think Chris Magnus would argue is part of the problem. There, you know, there have been a succession of police chiefs serving for a year or two and then leaving. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is the most difficult city department to change. And the idea that somebody from within the ranks of police department or coming from outside is going to shake things up and transform them in a year or two is magical thinking. I mean, people have to have strong support from city manager, if there is one, from the mayor, from the city council. They have to have a long-term plan, and they have to have enough time to patiently and persistently introduce very, very difficult changes that are often resisted by police unions, sometimes resisted by people in the community, and there was a lot of resistance to Chris Magnus's efforts initially. And there was controversy as recently as the fall of 2014 when he became the only police chief in the country to participate in a peaceful Black Lives Matter protest on the main street in Richmond, stood there with a Black Lives Matter sign, and personally expressed solidarity with other people in the community who at that time were very upset about police brutality cases that were making headlines in cities across the country, New York, Detroit, Baltimore, Cleveland,
and
other places.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Where was the backlash coming from?
Well, the backlash came from the local police officers union.
Mm.
You know, many police officers feel the Black Lives Matters movement is overly hostile to law enforcement personnel, and Chris was challenged on the fact that he appeared, you know, while on duty in uniform. Ultimately, things got patched up, and I think that to most of the newly hired Richmond cops understood that this was a very important symbolism on the part of a chief who had spent at that time close to 10 years repairing relationships with the community. And his gesture of solidarity was very much welcomed by just about everybody else. I mean, Magnus has also been tapped on several occasions by the Justice Department to be part of task force to go investigate, you know, the breakdown of policing in places like Ferguson, Missouri, and in Baltimore, Maryland. So he's a nationally recognized expert in improving public safety and has now moved on to become a police chief in Tucson, Arizona. Also, you know, at the moment, sanctuary city and one which, like Richmond, under when Chris was chief, you know, is not cooperating with the Trump administration or any kind of federal crackdown and roundup of undocumented immigrants, because that undermines any serious community policing effort in a community like Richmond with many immigrants and many of them undocumented.
You mentioned, I think you used the term, young new officers. So did this effort create some opportunity for new hires in the police department,
younger
fellows
definitely.
With a
the
different attitude?
Than, yeah.
Okay.
The police department now is about 70% non-white, many more women, Latinos and Asians. Richmond natives have been hired. Chris made a big effort to you know, hire people from non-military backgrounds. And that new hiring, that greater diversity, combined with very extensive and interesting retraining of police officers, a lot of emphasis on de-escalation of conflict and kind of nonviolent resolution of disputes, is one of the reasons we've had so few instances of police misconduct here and fatal shootings by the police. In a city where the cops still take a gun a day off people who should not have them.
Well, yeah, the data really support the success of your daring sheriff and the progressives that backed him up, took a chance on him, because out of your book is that there was 40 homicides in 2005 to 21 in 2015. So it was essentially cut in half. That's...
Yeah, I mean, it's a problem that waxes and wanes, and another part of the overall police or public safety reform strategy here I try to describe in the book as well is a civilian initiative called the Office of Neighborhood Safety, and this is both funded by taxpayer dollars and some private foundation grants. Office of Neighborhood Safety hires staff of formerly incarcerated, former gang member Richmond residents who do outreach to the young people who are currently involved in gang activity, tries to get some of them into a thing called the Peacemaker Fellowship Program, which provides them with a monthly stipend for nearly a year, job training opportunities, counseling, an opportunity to go back to school if people can. And this staff of pretty street-savvy men and women are also able to de-escalate at least some of the retaliatory shootings, which are one of the reasons why, you know, an act of gun violence will trigger another one and another one after that when disputes over drugs and neighborhood turf kind of enter the picture. You know, there's been such an increase in neighborhood confidence and willingness to work with the police and the Office of Neighborhood Safety to reduce that kind of gang-related gun activity, but that some of it has shifted the last year or two to the two major highways that intersect Richmond, Interstate 80 and 580. There's actually been more shootings out on the freeway, partly because people who have guns illegally and are using them to settle personal quarrels and engaging in other criminal activity no longer feel protected anywhere in the city. People will report their activity. The neighborhood watches and patrols will work with the police to solve homicides and property crimes, and the place has become a lot less hospitable to people drawn to criminal activity, again, in the case of young people, because of the lack of jobs and poor educational opportunities and broken families and a lot of the other social and economic problems that a city like this is still struggling with.
It's funny, so people have to go outside to fight.
not an ideal solution,
no, but it says something. Says something for the Office of Neighborhood Safety for sure, and that didn't come cheap, right? It's a $1 million program.
Yeah, but one that is being copied now in Oakland and Baltimore and other cities. I mean, I think both the Chris Magnus-led community policing effort and initiatives like the Office of Neighborhood Safety reflect a recognition that the old police model of cops as an occupying army and, deploying overly aggressive street teams and using cast-off military equipment to patrol and deal with civil disturbances, that this is a failed model. And you're not going to reduce crime. You're not going to engage the community. You're not going to win people's trust and confidence. You're going to alienate them. And I think that's the hard lesson that's been learned in Richmond, but that the model of the police department turnaround is one really that's is worth study and emulation in many other big cities with a similar mix of problems that we still have to a degree, but definitely had more of 10, 12 years ago.
So you shook up the police department, which I assume took progressives on the council to do, and then you had this program, Office of Neighborhood Safety, but there was also a civilian review commission instead of a Department of Internal Affairs, right?
Yeah, there's two kinds of checks on the police here that I think are very significant. One, extremely unusual. We, as police critics, rightly often complain. Most departments, when there is a complaint of police misconduct, that's investigated by an internal affairs branch or arm of the police department itself. It's basically an internal investigation. And now, in Richmond, if there's a complaint of police misconduct, it's investigated by a civilian independently from an Office of Professional Accountability that's located in City Hall. And that is a very rare, shouldn't be, but it is a very rare arrangement. Our current OPA director is a former police officer, but also a former lawyer and judge. And he already recently completed a major misconduct investigation that led to some suspensions and firings. We have a second check on the police, and that's the civilians who serve on an appointed police commission. And the police commission, its powers have recently been expanded. It is now mandated to investigate any use of force or racially abusive treatment that is of a serious sort, and so people can take their complaints about any police misconduct to two places in Richmond, both of them independent of the department. So this civilian oversight is it's now the police commission is now called the Citizens Police Review Commission. Mm-hmm. Has its own independent investigator, and again, is sort of a model for making sure that when there are cases of police misconduct, they're fully and fairly investigated.
Mm-hmm. Slightly related to the police issue and the community's wants, where are you guys on the sanctuary city issue and such, since you have such a minority population there?
In 2006, right after Gail McLaughlin first got elected Green Mayor, she, with support from others on the City Council, which at that time did not have a progressive majority, declared Richmond to be a sanctuary city, working with Chris Magnus, then police chief. Police made it very clear they were not going to cooperate with any federal crackdown and roundup of undocumented immigrants who were residents of the city. And that position, sanctuary city position, of course, has now been taken by a lot of other cities. Mm-hmm. Richmond's stand was reiterated by our current mayor, Tom Butt, who's a liberal Democrat, often an ally of progressives, and certainly on issues like this. So Richmond really was a pioneering sanctuary city, kind of paved the way for many other cities doing that in the Trump era. But the shift here took occurred more than 10 years ago.
Yeah, that's getting back there. So let me mention to listeners that we're speaking with author Steve Early. He's written the book Refinery Town, Big Oil, Big Money, and the Remaking of an American City. And that's about how the city of Richmond, California, went through a decade or so of grassroots organizing, led to a political transformation of the city. And if you would like to call in to ask any questions and join the conversation, the number here is 895-2448. It's area code 707-895-2448.
I wonder if we could talk a little bit now about the importance of local organizing and some of the things that you might be able to do on the local level that would be harder to do on a higher government level that's farther away. What are some of the things that a mayor could do that a governor couldn't?
Well, I think, though some of this is contested now with state legislatures and governors trying in many states, really, to curb progressive policy initiatives at the municipal level, certainly Richmond and many other cities have, with progressive leadership, tried to raise and improve local labor standards, mainly raising the minimum wage. Our minimum wage here goes to $13 an hour in January, and there's a renewed push to increase that as part of the broader Fight for 15 movement around the country. I think one of the key things that can be done at the local level, certainly in California, but sadly not in other states where this kind of initiative is prevented by state law, is rent control. Richmond last fall had a referendum on rent control by a 2-to-1 margin. Voters in the city approved an ordinance which establishes a rent board, which rolled back rents to the level they were a year before last fall, which limits future rent increases to the overall increase in the consumer price index. And I think most significantly, because it has broader impact, requires landlords to have just cause before evicting tenants. This applies to pre-1995 housing in the city. About 40% of it.
Excellent
tenants
program.
Are covered 10,000 units, maybe 20,000 people. And it's already having a positive impact. You know, Richmond is a city, like the rest of the Bay Area, affected by a real crisis of housing affordability. People have been forced out already of San Francisco because of high home prices and rents. Some then moved to Oakland. They've been pushed out of Oakland.
Yeah.
Gentrification trends there. Richmond is now a destination of choice, which is great. New people are moving in, but the effects of displacement were already evident, and that's why it took an 18-month campaign to overcome a huge amount of spending by the landlord lobby, California Apartment Association, and get rent control in, making Richmond one of the first cities in California in 30 years to adopt this approach to dealing with landlord-tenant disputes and out-of-control rent increases.
Well, that's right on time. We have a caller. Hi, you're on the air.
Annie and Steve, another excellent program I listen to from a great distance, and on the point of housing in Richmond, which I did live in as a kid in the era of the Second World War, a very desperate situation that has been massively improved. Is there yet another effort to get second homes, even on wheels or small conversions of garages, et cetera, so that more people can live less expensively, especially for the young starting and the elders? I'll take my answer on the air again.
Thank you.
Yeah, very good question. I was actually at a conference at City Hall yesterday. A wonderful organization called Saffron Strand, which is one of the leading organizations of working to find housing for homeless people in Richmond and help them get jobs and job training. And there was a series of presentations and workshops about the kind of tiny homes movement and new strategies for building more affordable housing. One limitation on this in Richmond and everywhere, of course, is that federal housing funding, or federal funding of affordable housing, declined over the 8 years of the Obama administration. Now, of course, we have a right-wing Trump administration that is not going to be a big promoter of public housing construction. In Richmond, that leaves you with the strategy of trying to negotiate deals with developers, would-be developers of market-rate housing, so that in return for city approval of their projects, the city is able to collect impact fees or linkage fees, as they're sometimes called, which will help finance greater construction locally of affordable housing for lower-income people, for seniors, and for others that would otherwise be priced out of the market here. So this whole question of how to make development benefit everyone and help finance further affordable housing construction at a time when state-level funding is not very generous is a major challenge.
We have another call. You're on the air.
Two short ones about rent control. I think Santa Rosa just had an election on the 6th, and I never heard the results. So if anybody knows that, that would be good. And otherwise, I wanted to ask where the Democrats and the progressives, where they cooperate, and then what kind of issues do they mostly oppose each other on?
Very good question. No, I know that it was on the ballot in Santa Rosa, and I have not don't know what the result was or exactly.
And Andy and Steve don't either?
No, I'm glad you asked that question. Now I'm curious.
All right. Yep. Haven't heard.
On the second question, at this point, as a result of two more progressives being elected last November, including a 26-year-old African-American Bernie supporter and tenant organizer, Melvin Willis, who was a very key leader of the rent control campaign, we have on the Richmond Council a supermajority of 5 out of 7 members. The other two are Liberal Democrats, Tom Butt, the mayor, and Gerald Myrick, who's often, like Tom, an ally in some issues and not others. I would say where the Liberal Dems have parted with the progressives have been on some labor issues, raising the minimum wage. They definitely were more sensitive to business community concerns about that. Tom Butt, our current mayor, while being very good on environmental issues and a longtime critic and challenger of Chevron misbehavior, was not a supporter of rent control and actively campaigned against it. I think both factions on the council have been supportive of the police reform that we were discussing earlier. Both have been critical of Chevron's the influence of its big money in politics. Both have been supportive of important election law reform. Richmond has a system of modest public matching funds so that when people who are not wealthy themselves and not getting big independent expenditures from big oil or big soda run for municipal office, their small Bernie Sanders-style private donations can be matched by funds from the city. So that also has been something supported here by the Left Liberal United Front. We now have represented in our city hall and on our city council.
You know, you were talking a little bit about the disagreements on the council between the Greens and the pro-business and then the people kind of that are swing votes in between. In your book, people really do get a clear understanding of how hard this is. It really takes guts. When you want to make changes like Gail McLaughlin and Chris Magnan and the Progressive Alliance, you got a fight on your hands. Do you want to talk a little bit about some of the strife that people went through to make all these wonderful changes?
Well, Richmond really has been a case study in the problem of unlimited corporate spending on politics, in this case local politics. As we know, the Supreme Court's decision, Citizens United, said that if corporations like Chevron set up so-called super PACs or independent expenditure committees, they can spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on behalf of the candidacy of someone running for city council or mayor who, if you were giving them an individual donation, you or I, we'd be limited to, you know, giving them $2,500 if we had it. In the last three election cycles in Richmond, a combination of Big Soda, the Beverage Association nationally, which was opposed to a soda tax proposal in Richmond, Big Oil in 2012, and the landlord lobby last year spent between $7 and $8 million, largely unsuccessfully, trying to elect pro-business candidates and smear and defeat progressive candidates. That's a huge amount of money in a city with an active electorate of 20 to 30,000 people. I think it really can only be countered by the development of a real strong grassroots organization like the Progressive Alliance in Richmond, hundreds of volunteers coming out in election year, knocking on doors, making phone calls, passing out literature, talking to their neighbors. Otherwise, you just get buried by big money buying up all the billboards, running TV and radio ads, bombarding everybody with glossy mailers and social media advertising. And in a lot of other cities, that kind of air war succeeds. Here in Richmond, it has not in recent years because people created grassroots organization, a bottom-up approach challenging corporate power in the electoral arena.
You described some of the city council meetings as cage fights. They were very rough.
Well, there was a period of time in recent history of city politics in 2013-2014 where one of our really courageous reformers in Richmond, Jovanka Beckles, who identifies as a black Latina lesbian, first gay person ever elected to the city council, came under attack by really vicious homophobic forces in the city, some old-line African-American ministers and community activists, people actually funded indirectly by Chevron. And they targeted Jovanka, they targeted Gail McLaughlin, they made a concerted effort to disrupt city council meetings and to kind of depict the progressives on the council at that time as a source of paralysis and dysfunction. And they tried to make that the basis for Chevron's campaign to unseat progressives in our big showdown election in 2014 when Chevron spent over $3.1 million on negative advertising against progressives and ads, billboards, mailers for a slate of four business-friendly candidates for mayor and city council, all of whom were defeated.
That's incredible.
Yeah, there's some amazing dirty tricks.
Let me mention again that we're speaking with Steve Early, and Steve is the author of Refinery Town, Big Oil, Big Money, and the Remaking of an American City. And the number here, if you'd like to join the conversation, is 895-2448.
So maybe we should talk a little bit about the dirty tricks from Chevron to get people kind of prepared for what you're up against. And in addition to cage fight type city council meetings, you were talking about, of course, they can overwhelm the election process with money. And one of the things they did that was interesting is there was a progressive candidate who was eminently qualified named Eduardo Martinez. And so Chevron funded another candidate with the same last name.
Well, coming from the Boston area, I was not unfamiliar with this.
Okay. I thought I was surprised.
it's a famous old strategy in South Boston. If you're an incumbent and your leading competition is coming from a guy named Kelly, you get another Kelly to get on the ballot, too, to create some voter confusion. But the Richmond version of that, as you note, 2 years ago, was we had a wonderful activist by the name of Eduardo Martinez, retired public school teacher, very active in educational reform activity, a leader of the Mexican-American Political Association in our city, running for city council as a critic of Chevron. He'd been on the city planning commission. He'd been very involved in the whole effort to attach necessary conditions to a city approval of a big Chevron modernization project. Chevron basically, independently, of course, and with no coordination with the candidate himself, recruited another Martinez, a former Richmond cop, a former postmaster in the city, had never been involved in politics before or community service other than his government jobs, to run against him. So, again, the only way that you can counter the dirty tricks, the 30-to-1 spending disadvantage that candidates here have had to overcome, is by developing your own independent grassroots fundraising capacity, Bernie Sanders-style small donations matched by public matching funds, and a year-round organization that builds up a progressive voter database that starts canvassing very early in election years, runs candidates as a team, as a slate, as all of the Richmond progressive candidates here run together. So the impact of their electoral activity is magnified. When people vote for them, they know that they are corporate-free. They don't accept corporate donations. And they're committed to implementing a common platform or program. It's not just about their own career advancement and personal ambition. So that really sets them aside here from all the liberal and corporate Dems that they run against in Richmond.
I know another dirty trick was Chevron came out with a phony newspaper, the Richmond Standard, and a phony radio station, Free Radio Richmond, that were purporting to be the news, but they were really Chevron news.
Chevron has spent heavily on these alternative, quote-unquote, news sources. It's got very deep pockets for public relations campaigns as needed in the city. It is also the biggest philanthropist in the city. It gives out grants to a lot of groups doing necessary social service work, Police Athletic League, children's breakfast programs, senior centers, all kinds of nonprofits and churches. And, it really is a case of what I think Jane Mayer in her book Dark Money calls weaponized philanthropy. At the same time, the company doesn't want to pay its fair share of taxes through property taxation or other forms. It wants to dole out grants to kind of win hearts and minds, to wield influence in the community. And that targeted philanthropy is pretty sophisticated. It's year-round, and it's in many cases not a substitute for an expansion of public programs and services that would be possible in Richmond if we had a stronger tax base and leading employers like Chevron were paying their fair share of taxes.
So I looked on the website of the Richmond Progressive Alliance, and I'm glad to see they are so busy. Their calendar is just full. For last month, a bus to Sacramento to testify against jail expansion, a building trades career fair, all kinds of stuff going on. You want to talk about ongoing education and activities?
Yeah, and I think a lot of what you just mentioned really reflects the understanding that you can only do so much at the city level. We have an issue here with the county sheriff, who's based in Martinez, Contra Costa County. The sheriff operates a youth detention facility in Richmond. The county supervisors, only one of whom really reflects Richmond interests, just voted millions of dollars, allocated millions of dollars to a jail expansion plan that residents of Richmond, the Richmond elected city leadership, opposes. We're very concerned the the sheriff, who's quite tight with the Trump administration, is going to use this expanded jail to incarcerate undocumented immigrants who may be rounded up by ICE. So there's also issues with the county district attorney. So there's organizing going on now with like-minded groups in other cities within the county, within two neighboring counties, so that a network of East Bay city-based progressive groups can come together and work on some common campaigns. In our assembly district, number 15, we're running a great candidate, Jovanka Benkels, who's been a leader of the Richmond Progressive Movement for the last 6 or 8 years. She's running for state assembly as a corporate-free candidate, as a hopefully a Bernie Sanders-backed progressive. And I think, you know, if you want to change the property tax system, that's got to be a statewide campaign. There's lots of changes that have to be made at the county and the state level, of course, the federal level eventually, too. And I think the organizing that's going on now is really aimed at linking people up inside the city with allies of all types outside of it.
Okay, we are just about out of time. Just enough time for you to tell people the name of your book again and how to find it and how to find out more about you.
I have a website, steveearley.org. There's some info about the book there. It can be ordered directly from a great social justice movement publisher in Boston, Beacon Press. Go to beaconpress.org. You can also get the book from your nearest independent bookstore.
Like we did.
Like we did, indeed.
We all want to keep them afloat, whether it's the great independent bookstores in up in Arcata and Humboldt County or in Ukiah or Mendocino Village. Lots of cities and towns have independent bookstores. We're not going to have them unless we patronize them. So that would be my first stop, to order a copy of Refine Every Time.
Hey, thank you so much, Steve Earle.
Thanks for having me on the show.
This has been really, really great. Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I've been listening to Corporations and Democracy, broadcast on second and fourth Tuesdays from 1 to 2 here on KCYX and Z. The next edition will be in 2 weeks. That's June 27th with rotating hosts Lynn McClure and possibly Tony Rizzo. Annie and I will return in a month. That's Tuesday, July 11th. And for further information about what you can do to correct the corporate dominance of our democracy, go to www.thealliancefordemocracy.org. Thanks for listening.